So yes, sometimes the world turns in the direction we want, and sometimes it doesn't. And the Serenity Prayer, we change those things that we can, and then there are many things that we can't change, so we have to cultivate a sense of equanimity and patience. So generally Buddhism, especially Zen, it presents a very large container. You don't put anybody outside the circle, or anything outside the circle. It doesn't mean you don't work with it. It doesn't mean you don't try to change it. It doesn't mean you just totally, accept everything that this is the way it is and you don't do anything. It doesn't mean that. But it means that you, even things that are difficult, you see it as inside the circle. Somehow it's come to you as something to work with. So I just got back last night. God, it seems like about a week ago, but I got back last night. As you know, I went to Reno, the Berkeley Zen Center that I have an affiliation with, because the abbot of that Zen Center is, I'm in that lineage in Dharma transmission. And Mel Weitzman, 86 years old, still going strong, leading sesshins and teaching. So about 20 people from that sangha and some other sanghas went to Carson City, and there was a person there that was a Zen student, and we stayed at this person's house, and we had an election sesshin, something that they've been doing, not every year, but usually when there's kind of a hot spot around, it seems like there's somebody could really use some help. So we went, and so we would get up in the morning and sit for two periods of meditation, and then we'd have a service. We'd chant the Heart Sutra and the Metta Sutra, and then we'd go down, and we had a tenzo. Tenzo is the person that cooks, that had breakfast ready, and we'd take turns being on the cooking crew like we do, just like in the monastery. And then we'd do the dishes, and we'd have a little meeting, talk about the day and what happened the day before. And then we'd go down to the Democratic headquarters, whether it was in Carson City or whether it was in Reno, and we told them. And they were all incredibly well organized. They had their clipboards, and we paired up in twos, and then we took off from various parts of the city, and we had a little clipboard. And basically, they made it easy on us. They only sent us to registered Democratic voters. So it had been going on about a week and a half before the election night. I only got there the last five nights. And then we knock on the door, and we try to get them to vote early. In that state, you can actually vote, actually go and vote, not just an absentee ballot. So we try to get them to do that. Sometimes we take them to the polls. Sometimes we knock on the door, and even though they were registered Democrats, they were going to vote for Trump, and they were not happy to see us or the literature we were presenting. They slammed the door in our face. A lot of Latinos that we met were just, you could tell they were very happy about voting. There was one of the rays of light was, of course, that Nevada, went Democratic. And the woman that we were also campaigning for very strongly was Kathleen Cortez Masto, who was the Attorney General and running for the Harry Reid Senate seat. So we thought that was very important to try to, and she did, she won. She beat the incumbent. So, and so we're proud of that particular effort. That will make a difference. And then we would come back at about 6, have dinner, and talk a little bit, and then sit another period of Zazen, and then go to bed, and then get up and do the same thing again. So one reason I did it was not only to try to do what I could do, but also to do kind of put myself in unfamiliar territory. I wanted to kind of see, because here we're pretty insulated. We don't meet people that have strong feelings, like it seems like many people in the country have. So I went there to just see what that was like, what it felt like, and I did. I did have some encounters. One fellow, I was in a particularly low, economically depressed area of Carson City, and we were there, and this guy gets out of the car. This old guy was even in his 60s, but big guy, kind of a tough-looking guy. And I was with this guy who was driving this old Lexus, kind of an old beat-up Lexus, actually. And the guy looks at the car and he says, "Pretty upscale car for this neighborhood, isn't it?" He was driving an old beat-up Chevy. I think he thought we were, you know, cops or something. I don't know, but so he could see all my. But then he saw my campaign buttons. He started going up the stairs and he said, "I used to vote Democratic," he said, "but then I changed." And then each step, there's about 13 seats, each step he gave me a lecture on why, you know, he was voting for Trump. So about halfway up, what his particular grievance was around, you know, multicultural society, letting Muslims in the country. He felt incredibly strongly about letting refugees come in, Syrian refugees in, how that was threatening his safety and the safety of the country. So, you know, what I wanted to tell him was, I said, my mother was an immigrant. She came from Italy. And Italians faced a lot of prejudice when they came, just like the Irish did, just like the Jews did, just like the Germans did during the Revolutionary War. People didn't want to let them in. So at each point in our history, you know, the group that came in just before resists the next group, because it kind of gives them a sense of self-importance. And I wanted to tell him that, yeah, there were some Italians that came in that didn't do nice things, but in the aggregate, you know, think of the incredible wealth and how much richer our society is for each wave that comes in. But I didn't say that, because it was clear that there wasn't any room to say that. I felt that what I could do was listen to him and be very conscious of my body and my mind and my face, and I just wanted to listen. I wanted to convey to him that I could at least listen, even though I didn't share his concern, that I could at least listen to his discomfort and his concern, his anger, actually. And that often is the best we can do. And generally, you know, Suzuki Roshi was, most people that seem to practice Zen tend to tend towards the progressive end of the spectrum, but there are some exceptions. I mentioned a couple weeks ago I did a day retreat with a bunch of vets, and most of the vets were Trump supporters. The reason I know that is because we have them not talk about politics, but my wife is friends with them on Facebook, and so she sees the dialogue, and it's pretty radical. But when we're there, because we don't talk at that level, we're talking at another level about how do we just address our pain, not how to address it politically, but how do we just address it emotionally and through meditative practice. And so that's very helpful, to be able to have some way we can connect with people in such a universal way. And so we'd like to create a forum where people feel comfortable to come and do that. Churches, religious organizations have been a place where that forum exists. I've been looking on the web. I've got some emails that came to me, people trying to sort this out, you know, trying to figure out what happened. You know, such a surprise. And so Garrison Keillor, you want anybody here listening to the Prairie Home Companion? You know who he is, right? So he's pretty good. I didn't know how strongly he felt. You know, he's kind of retired, so I guess he's coming out more in terms of his real feelings. But he felt pretty strongly, pretty discouraged by it. But he basically said, you know, just take the big view. He says, go do something nice for yourself. Start to read books. Take walks on the beach. He says, basically, you have to let things play out. He says, things will melt. They'll just melt down, you know, he says, you just have to trust that this particular political party has control right now, and just see what happens. And he was pretty confident that that it would melt down of its own accord. Here's what Norman says. So Norman Fisher's Buddhist priest, my Dharma brother, and also an inspiration to me. He actually gave me Dharma transmission, and Milt Weissman, who I just talked about, gave Norman transmission, and Suzuki Roshi gave Milt transmission. So we're in that lineage. She says, I don't completely believe, I usually don't completely believe what I think. That's a good strategy, by the way. You know, don't always believe completely what you think. Your mind has a personality of its own. Just like you don't necessarily have to believe completely what you feel. You know, just because you feel fear or whatever, that doesn't mean objectively that's substantiated, right? But you do have to be in touch with it, what you're thinking and feeling. I usually don't completely believe what I think. So when Trump won the election, I was, like everybody else, surprised. But not that surprised. Bodhisattvas are committed to their practice, which means to sit, to get up, and sweep the garden, the whole world. Close in and far away, every day, no matter what. You know, that's our vow. Sentient beings are numberless. We vow to save them, but I actually like the translation. Sentient beings are numberless. We vow to wake up with them. They have always done this. They always will. Good times, bad times, they keep on going just the same. Bodhisattvas play the long game. They have confidence in the power of goodness over time. And they know that dark times bring out the heroic in us. For those older among us who hold liberal and progressive political views, we're having a little conversation about the silent parking lot. Let's not forget we survived Nixon, Reagan, and Bush. It wasn't pleasant, but we survived. We will survive Trump. This is not to say that the policies of these presidents weren't bad and that they did not make any lasting impact. They were, and they still did. Still, we survived. We will survive Trump. And as of today, we don't really know what will happen under Trump because nothing he has said so far means much. He seems not to have much commitment to his own words. We have been fortunate to have 8 years of a decent, intelligent, thoughtful, and caring human being in the White House. This is more than we have expected. Let's not forget that the same people who elected Obama elected Trump. It's okay to freak out, grieve, and vent for a while. Hold each other's hands. Then we can get back to the work, as always, for the good. Think of what the Dalai Lama has gone through in his lifetime. He maintains his daily practice. He maintains kindness for everyone, though he has lost his country and his culture at the hands of a brutal regime. Yet he doesn't hate the Chinese and finds redeeming features in them. He maintains his sense of humor. He has turned his tragedy into a teaching for the world. Let's do the same. So that was from Norman. So I often think, you know, when I bow in the morning, every morning when I do meditation, I light some incense and do three bows for Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And I often think, thank you, Buddha, one of the many things I thank you for, but one thing I thank, not just him, but the teachings for, because of course there are many women that brought us the teachings too. Is I thank you for my breath. You know, I didn't really pay close attention to my breath. I just took it for granted, probably until I was in my late 20s, when I took up meditation. And my breath, you know, breath means spirit, right? The Greek word for breath is spirit. I mean, it connects us all. But I use it often as a metaphor for not only when I'm working, trying to sort things out politically or something difficult or just something emotional in my own life. I think of my breath is even as two parts that come together as a whole. It's a lot like in the Heart Sutra where it says form and emptiness. We have the realm of form, but we have the realm of emptiness where everything is connected. And our work is to try to find how that comes together, how that reality is true. So the in-breath for me is I try to feel on the in-breath. I'm breathing in, I'm feeling. I'm feeling the breath, I'm feeling my stomach, I'm feeling my chest, I'm feeling depressed, I'm feeling anxious, I'm feeling resistance, I'm feeling anger, I'm feeling whatever I feel, you know? And then on my out-breath, I try to create some sense of spaciousness and letting it go. Now, of course, it doesn't immediately, if you're having some strong feeling, it just doesn't go with the out-breath. You may have to work with that, but you work with the metaphor that there's something more than just getting stuck with your feeling or your thought, that there's some bigger space, and we begin to trust Buddha's teaching about impermanence, that things come and things go. So in the Lotus Sutra, you know, it says everything is like a flash of lightning in a bubble. So we begin to see in our meditation that we don't need to hang on to things. And we begin to trust more the transitoriness of things. I didn't know that, you know, so well in the 70s. When I came back, I'd spent 2 years in the Peace Corps in Africa. In the late 69, things were pretty crazy. The world was on fire. Remember? Many of us remember that. There were a lot of bombings in this country. A lot, actually. I remember once hearing the statistic. I couldn't believe how many there were. People were really upset. And I was upset. And as kind of a newly minted attorney, I went and joined the National Lawyers Guild. And some of you know this. And we went and we were representing the Black Panthers. And so we'd take turns. And I would go over to the Panther headquarters and spend the night. The idea being that if the police came, because they had just shot up the L.A. Panther office, that as an attorney, I'd be there and ask for their search warrant. You know, and hopefully they wouldn't shoot me up. So I did that for a while, but more and more I got, I could feel I was on this cusp, because I had just been traveling in India and Japan for about 6-7 months. So there was something that got imprinted in, and also I'd been interested in Buddhism for a long, long time, probably 10 years before when I lived in Hawaii. And then a couple things happened. One thing that happened was that somebody came to my office and said, you know, I hear you're a radical lawyer and I'm gonna go blow up the police station, the park station, and I want you to defend me. And I said, no, I can't do that. Actually, later, right now, there's a person in my Sangha in Occidental who found out about that story and came up. She says, well, I'm glad, you know, you didn't agree to do that, because my uncle was an officer at that station, and they actually did blow up the station. Set a bomb off in it, and some people were hurt. Some policemen were hurt. And another one was, you remember the Bay Guardian? I went to a protest, you know, and I went by this picture, the Bay Guardian, and I went by this picture and I said, wow, that guy with a clenched fist, you know. I said, that guy is really angry. I think I'd just come from a macrobiotic class or something. I went by and I stopped and I went back and I looked. It was actually me. It was a picture of me. And so I had this strong, more and more this feeling, that isn't where I wanted to go. I wasn't feeling good inside. And so I started to go to San Francisco Zen Center and started to meditate, and went to a Monday night class where some of you were there, trying to get some teachings about how to work with all this in a different way than through violence. And I used to throw the I Ching. You guys know the I Ching? Anybody here ever throw the I Ching? I see some smiles. I still do occasionally. And I uncannily used to come up with the same one more times than was mathematically possible. And it was number 49, Po, revolution. And I read, so this is 1969, and I kept coming up with this number 49. And number 49 says, in various places, the revolutionary must then proceed in the right way, so that he gladdens the people, and by enlightening them prevents success. Furthermore, he or she must be quite free of selfish aims and must really relieve the needs of the people. Only then does he have nothing to regret. So the true revolutionary gladdens the hearts of the people. And if we think about the people that have really influenced us deeply, think about Mandela. What, 25 years? 27 years? Mobilar prison? You know, he didn't know if he was ever going to get out. But he just had this practice, this every day, being consistent, being human to the guards. Eventually he won them over, over many years. And eventually he won through just that persistent, quiet effort, his release. And then he went on to lead his country. And, you know, at various points, if you read his story or seen the movies, you know, where the country was ready in flames to really retaliate. And he said, no, you're not going to do that. That's not the way we're going to proceed. And he had the strength of character enough to prevent that excess. But then they started a process of reconciliation. And Gandhi, you know, where during the Second World War, people came up and said, you know, now's our time. We can start to align with the Japanese and defeat the British. And he said, we're not going to do that. He says, we've known them a long time, and that is not the way we're going to end our relationship with them. And Martin Luther King. Same thing. So they had this quality, this spiritual quality within, where they valued the humanness of everybody. And they really, and they gladdened the heart of their followers. And so that's why they were so effective. Remember, I was talking about, I did talk about my trip to night to L.A. when I went to see the cave, the Gunshan Cave, right, and also the Lotus Sutra, not the Lotus, but the Diamond Sutra, oldest book in the world was there. One of the things that amazed me was this complex, they started digging caves in the 2nd century Common Era, went up to the 15th century. So that sweep of history, you know, the Tang Dynasty came through, the Song Dynasty came through. In the 9th century, there was this huge persecution, one of the emperors decided he didn't like Buddhism. He wanted to go back to just pure Taoism. And he persecuted all the monasteries, killed thousands of monks. This was in the 9th century. You know, and somehow this place survived, you know. And then the sand swept in from the Gobi Desert and covered it almost all up, forgotten for 900 years. Then somebody started digging it out, and now it's a pretty major tourist attraction. And there's a real revitalized interest in Buddhism in China right now. So the sweep, the ebb and sweep of time, you know, that we begin to see things not just in the kind of the microcosm. So they gave me some sense, you know, just sense of time and some sense of patience and some sense of knowing when to act and when not to act. And so I'm thinking myself, you know, one part of me, one part of me needs to be able to stand up for what's right, what feels right, and stand up for what is not right. And the other part of me also needs to reach out and completely try to understand. And which is hard in our context, because we don't meet too many people that are not, that don't think like us. I've been doing some work with police. I'm meeting with a police chief in Petaluma in a couple of weeks with some other, actually a couple of retired court justices, and we're trying to originate kind of a dialogue with the police and the community to teach them some listening skills. And I've already met with the police chief in Sebastopol. But they're different. They have a different mindset. You know? One ex-policeman in the paper this morning from Petaluma said, oh, I'm so happy that Trump got elected. So I've never heard Glenn Beck. You know, I've just heard about him. So even, you know who he is, right? So even he said in the paper that he said, the reason why this is happening is because nobody's talking to each other. He says, I've made this mistake. I'm going to correct it. I'm going to start talking to people who don't believe the way I do. Which means basically you have to listen. You have to do a lot of listening so people can calm down enough so you know that you're there for them. And then maybe there's some opening. Maybe there won't be an opening. Maybe all you can do is listen. But maybe they can just feel something. Some seeds will be planted. So Jack Kornfield, you know, one of the founders of Spirit Rock. So here's what he sent out in response yesterday, in response to the election. Take time to quiet the mind and tend to the heart. Then go out and look at the sky. Remember vastness. There are seasons to all things. Gain and loss, praise and blame, expansion and contraction. Learn from the trees. You know, that this I Ching is one of the oldest books in the world. And that's what it says. Two things. One is perseverance furthers. Persevering in the bodhisattva path in the sense of what we can feel to be right and true. And that the cycles of things, that's what this book's about. Sometimes there's a time for revolution, and sometimes there's a time to sit quiet. And so the wise person understands those seasons. Learn from the trees. Practice equanimity and steadiness. Remember the timeless Dharma amidst it all. Think of the best of human goodness. Let yourself become a beacon of integrity with your thoughts, words, and deeds. Integrity in speech and action, virtue and non-harming bring blessings. Remember the noble truths, no matter the politics or the season. Greed, hate, and ignorance cause suffering. Let them go. Love, generosity, and wisdom bring the end of suffering. Foster them. Remember the Buddha's counsel. Quote, hatred never ends by hatred, but by love alone is healed. That's in the Dhammapada, which is one of the very early sutras from Buddha. This is the ancient and eternal law. The human heart has freedom in itself to choose love, dignity, and respect. In every circumstance, embody respect and cultivate compassion for all. Let yourself become a beacon of Dharma. Amidst the changes, shine with courage and trust. Love people, and this is your world. Plant seeds of goodness and water them everywhere. Then blessings will grow for yourself and for all. So, you know, I've in here mentioned to you the Lojong teachings, which I give you periodically here and there. There's 59 of them, you know. And so the first four of the 59 slogans, these are from the Tibetan tradition that I've been teaching them, you know, in more of the Zen through Norman's book called Zen Teachings of Compassion. So the first four are based with meditation. So they say, before you go out and deal with the difficulties of the world, you have to have a stable base. So they give you the four slogans of meditation practice, which is notice that your consciousness is always impermanent. Everything that comes, goes. Notice that. Notice that the mind has a capacity to expand. There's no limit to the ability of your consciousness to include things. It can be very expansive, and you can get a taste of that when you quiet the mind and the thinking begins to abate. You can begin to sense not much in there that's starting to fragment things. But then the next slogan is wonderful. It says, don't get attached to peace, which means don't get attached to the mind that is only peaceful. You know, be able to stay with the mind that's also disturbed. And then the next one is be a child of illusion. And I'll lecture on each of these independently, but being a child of illusion means always be ready for the next moment. Like Suzuki Roshi says, Zen mind, beginner's mind. Always have the mind that's ready for potential, because things will be changing. So your mind, you train the mind to be ready that the next moment will be different. And it has a certain freshness and a certain naivete to it, like the mind of a child. You know, think of a child playing, right? Everything delights the child. You know, it's like, oh, oh, oh. You know, that kind of spirit, that's what that means. And then it goes into what happens when difficulties come. You know, it's like one of the main slogans is turn every difficulty onto the path. So this is difficult for some people. So how do we turn this onto the path? And the two slogans, there are many slogans that help, but the two that can be particularly helpful, I've mentioned before. One is called drive all blames into one, which doesn't mean go around blaming yourself. It means take responsibility for your own state of mind. You know, instead of blaming out there, take responsibility for your own clarity of mind. You know, no matter what is happening out there, your state of mind is your responsibility. That's one teaching that we have to remind ourselves over and over again. And then the next one is be grateful to everybody. Now that's a tough one, because you start off by being grateful with people that help you. You know, everybody in the Sangha, thank you for coming so I can sit and share the Dharma with you and you can share it with each other. But also, what about Trump? How can you be grateful to Trump? So I've been working on that. So who was it? Matthew, you told me. I gave a Dharma talk up there to this group. I said, I'm not quite ready to put Trump's picture on my altar. Which Matthew shared with me that Ram Dass has done. Can't quite do that. I can't even actually listen to his voice. I mean, I'll be honest with you, it's pretty hard. But he's taught me a lot. One thing he's taught me is about my own, every seed that he has, I have. The seed of narcissism or the seed of needing to be recognized, puffed up, I have those. We all have some more developed than others. So it helps me see those within myself. I also can see his suffering. Anybody that has that amount of, that need to be acknowledged. Narcissism, the root of almost all narcissism is a sense of insecurity. You know, if you know his relationship with his father, that's, you know, the seeds are embedded there. So I see that he actually suffers. The way he thinks can't bring him joy. I mean, it brings joy at one level, but not deep peace. And the other thing that he's helped me is I am trying to really feel the pain of the people that voted for him. I disagree. But I could understand their resistance. People don't like change, you know, and there's a huge tectonic shift in this country. People are very hard for people to give up male dominance, very hard to give up you're not, Christian's not the dominant religion, you know, little things like Islamic religion, Buddhism, secularism is eroding this, you know, homogeneous way to practice religion. And economics, you know, we're having to share with the rest of the world. So, you know, incomes are going up in Mexico and they're going up in China and they're going up in India, and you have to share the wealth, and so they're going down in this country. There's some rebalancing going on, and that's very painful. I mean, like, what did you say? Well, if you go back to your hometown, you go to these towns in the Midwest, you don't have to go very far. I was just up in Weaverville this summer, and you can see, you know, there's just not a lot of vitality there. And people that are living there, you know, they don't have any transgender people, they don't have any black people up there. All these things that everybody's all excited about, they can't relate to them. What they relate to is that their income has been stagnant or has been decreasing. And that causes a lot of pain. And so I have to feel that. And I have to figure out, I don't know what we can do about it. I can't imagine Trump, you know, he's not going to do anything by lowering the corporate tax rate to 15. You know, that's just so naive. It's ridiculous. But it'll have to play out. But in the meantime, there'll be a lot of suffering. So part of the job of the Bodhisattva is to feel that, is to be open to that. So I was going to read you to sing about the Dalai Lama. Maybe I don't have time, because I wanted to give 5 minutes for you guys to say something. But here's what the Dalai Lama says. He basically says the world, you know, the West, everybody wants to come to the West, and the West is on fire, right? Where all this discontent's happening, you know? Briex, France is voting conservative because of the Muslim influence. What just happened in our country, this is part of the big movement that's happening all over Western civilization. That's helpful to acknowledge. This isn't isolated, what's going on. And what he says here is that he says what he wants to remind people, he says, is that people need to feel useful. They need to feel valued. And in our country, because we're a materialistic country, the way that is usually through work. It's the growing number of people who feel they are no longer useful, no longer needed, no longer one with their societies. The America today, compared with 50 years ago, 3 times as many working age men are completely outside the workforce. This pattern is occurring throughout the developed world, and the consequences are not merely economic. Feeling superfluous is a blow to the human spirit. It leads to social isolation and emotional pain, and creates conditions for negative emotions to take root. It's from the Dalai Lama. That's what happens. I mean, that's part of what happens. It's a big part of what happens. So how that's addressed, well, we'll hopefully all be part of that. So would anybody like to share any feelings that they have or any perspectives they have about this?
Trump's narcissism, the insecurity. My parents lived in a building in New York City that Trump's father built. And so when I was about 15, I went down to the lobby one day, and there was Trump and his dad. And his dad was, as I remember, Dad was, you know, reading the Riot Act in some way, and Trump was there in this, like, schlumpy, humiliated kind of stance. And either I remember this or I'm making this up, but his father gave him a slap in the back of the head. So, so I've been following him for about 55 years now. And I'm struggling to feel loving towards him. But I do feel like the white working classes, people in these areas, that automation and globalization affected them, that they were left behind. And it's almost like not fully enslaved. You know, that it's like the new black. New
Say that again.
He's been a Democrat for most of his life, so maybe the only hope there is that he's been...
I didn't know that. Is that true?
Up until a few years ago, he's been a Democrat. And he's done this because he saw that there's an opening for what, for how he can make this move. So it's a possibility that he won't be as crazy, but his followers...